Hi, I'm Katie Marquette, and you're listening to Born of Wonder.
And here there is something more than just a transient experience.
It's about being. It's about the things that matter to me. It's about the white spaces between the paragraphs.
Then God said, "Let there be light."
The mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing.
What you just heard there was the bagpipes playing outside of the Baltimore Basilica, America's first cathedral, back in 2019. Every year in Baltimore, the Sunday nearest St. Patrick's Day, everyone dresses in green and the priests enter the church followed by bagpipers in festive traditional dress. After Mass, the bagpipers lead everyone out for the annual St. Patrick's Day parade through the city. It's a really rare moment of shared celebration. It's so much fun. Unfortunately, it's already come and gone this year. They did it on March 10th. This year. I'm actually surprised they didn't do it right on St. Patrick's Day, since St. Patrick's Day is a Sunday this year. But if you're in the DMV area, it's something to put on your calendar for next year. It's so beautiful. Well, welcome to Born of Wonder. I'm Katie Marquette, and on this podcast, we explore anything and everything that inspires wonder and awe in the world. Coming to you from a very blustery March day, the wind was just howling all night long, lost power briefly. It's definitely proving that saying true, march in like a lion, out like a lamb. I looked up where that comes from. It's from Thomas Fuller's 1732 Compendium of Adages and Proverbs. Just a true statement, right? March comes in like wintertime, it goes out hopefully like springtime. I don't know, maybe you can hear the door. We have like big front doors and the wind just like howls in the cracks of these big doors. It's very sort of medieval sounding at night when you can just hear everything, sort of the wind just whipping through the countryside and through the windows and everything. Yes, here we are, St. Patrick's Day week. St. Patrick's Day is coming up this Sunday. Great time of year. Certainly one Saint's Day that has you know, had cross-cultural, cross-religious appeal. I don't know how many people toasting with Guinness this weekend will be thinking of St. Patrick's, but St. Patrick, the famous saint who brought Christianity to Ireland, expelled the snakes from Ireland, taught all about the Trinity with the three-leaf clover. I don't know how many people are thinking about St. Patrick, but let's hope they are. Let's hope that they are toasting in his honor. So today on the podcast, we'll be exploring a medley of stories with audio taken from the many episodes I've done on the Celtic legends and folklore of the Irish Isles. We'll be hearing the story of Oisin and Niamh on the land of Tir na n-Uaig, the land of eternal youth. And we'll hear about Oisin's famed debate with St. Patrick, of course, representative of the sort of pagan debate, reckoning with the coming of Christianity, a complicated one to be sure. We'll also learn about the abandoned Irish island of Blasket and get lost in some eerie, beautiful Selkie stories. We will also learn all about the history of the famous and outstandingly beautiful Book of Kells, the illuminated manuscript housed in Trinity College in Dublin, once described as the work of angels and not of men. So beautiful. We'll hear about one of Ireland's patron saints, St. Columba, and how he rebuked and banned the Loch Ness Monster. No use looking for Nessie. St. Columba already banished him. And also at the end of this episode, we'll enjoy some poetry by Yeats, all about the lost fairy folk, the stolen child, and the wonderfully romantic poem, When You Are Old, read by my husband, Chris. So it's going to be a lot of fun. We're just immersing ourselves in the magical traditions and stories of Ireland. And Ireland is magic, right? It was always the place in my imagination where, you know, where those thin places were, where the barrier between heaven and earth was very, very thin. And that, you know, the storytelling tradition, for those of us with Irish ancestry, I think we hold on to that very dearly. We feel such a connection and kinship to this sort of magical other world represented in Ireland. It is a magical place, and you know, Irish literature is such a literary tradition, amazing literary tradition, and just this storytelling tradition. You know, it was very common for Irish storytellers to tell stories for weeks at a time. Everybody would gather around the fire at night and hear an ongoing tale that would take, you know, a fortnight to complete, and that was really a part of Irish culture for a long, long time. And the Irish language, I love the sort of the soft sounds in Irish. I love Irish names. It's just, yeah, just magic. So I hope you enjoy these stories. You'll also get to hear sort of varying things about my voice. You know how your voice changes when you're pregnant? When I'm reading or talking about the story of Oisín and Niamh and the land of eternal youth, I was so pregnant. I was like about to have Jojo. I was like a couple days later, so you can kind of hear that I'm sort of out of breath. you can sort of you can listen in these past episodes, you know, can see, try to see what's going on in my life. You know, I think in the Selkies, when I think that was before the girls, and I think the Book of Kells was pretty soon after Lucy was born. So, you know, I love that this podcast series has sort of just followed me through to these different phases in my life, and I've loved that I get to share that with you. So it's a wonderful history to explore here, and clearly the legends of Ireland I keep coming back to. I think they are stories that stay with me. I've talked before about my love of this Nat Geo documentary from the 80s, Ballad of the Irish Horse. There's so much to explore. If you want to watch the movie, it's a wonderful animated film, A Song of the Sea. Actually, I'll play that for you. I'm going to play that for you before we launch into everything. This great song called Song of the Sea, the same name as that movie, which is all about Selkies. It's a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story about family and love and magic and all those good things. So, of course, I have to tell you that if you're enjoying all this, you've got to come to Ireland. You've got to sign up. I'll put a link in the show notes. We're going to be seeing, we'll go visit Our Lady of Knock. We will hike St. Patrick's Mountain. We'll visit ancient monasteries. We'll see a sheep herding demonstration. We'll go to Trinity College and see the Book of Kells. We'll do a literary pub crawl through Dublin. It's going to be so incredible. We hear our traditional music in the countryside, have high tea at a castle. It's talk about magic. So want to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. I hope you can go ahead and sign up. If you have any questions, of course, feel free to email me or Christy. I would love if you would consider joining us. But without further ado, let's listen to this beautiful song, Song of the Sea, and then enjoy this just medley of magical, magical Irish stories. I wish you a very, very safe, happy St. Patrick's Day, happy March, all good things. What's the famous Irish blessing? May the road rise to meet you, may the wind be always at your back, may the sun shine warm upon your face and rain fall soft upon your fields, and until we meet again, may God hold you in the hollow of his hand.
Between the hill, between the between the north, between the south, between the west, between the Searching for love again.
So the Book of Kells is a beautiful illuminated manuscript created around 800 CE, contains the four Gospels of the Christian New Testament, and it's currently housed at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. They will only display a few pages at any given time. I think they used to change it every day, have a new page every day, but now they wait like a month or two. So it depends on when you go to visit what page you will see in person. The work is the most famous of the medieval illuminated manuscripts for the intricacy, detail, and just absolute majesty of the illustrations. I am going to put a link in the show notes. They have a fully digitized copy of the Book of Kells available online, so you can go through it yourself. You can zoom in and look at all these amazing Celtic knots that are interwoven into the letters, and just these little details, little figures that are popping out on the different letters on the side of the page. You can really see the personality of the illuminators coming out. This is a beautiful book. It is a true work of art. And so it's thought that the book was created as a showpiece for the altar, not really for daily use, because a lot more attention was given to the artwork than the text. In fact, so there's misspelling. Some of the gospel passages are misquoted or unfinished. Most of the priests who would be using it already knew the gospels by heart. They wouldn't really be reading from it. They would be using it as a evangelistic tool, as a sign of beauty at sacramental services, at the Mass and special occasions. So like I said, the beauty of the lettering, just absolutely stunning. You'll see portraits of the evangelists with their different, motifs. You'll see, Matthew is represented as a man, Mark as a lion, Luke as a calf, and John as an eagle. So you'll see all of those in the Book of Kells. You'll also see a lot of intricate Celtic knotwork motifs, which has really been praised by writers throughout the centuries. And like I said, it's from about 800 CE thereabouts, and produced by the monks of St. Columba's Order of Iona, Scotland, but not exactly sure where it is made. That is disputed. Theories range from that it was created on the island of Ionia to Kells, Ireland, to even in somewhere in Britain. But it was at least mostly it was created at Iona and then probably brought to Kells to keep it safe from Viking raiders in about 795. And then it may have ended up after that in Britain. A Viking raid in 806 CE killed 68 monks at Iona and led to the survivors abandoning the abbey in favor of another and their order at Kells. And so it's likely at that point is when the Book of Kells traveled with them and probably was completed in Ireland. As a physical object, the book measures 13 by 10 inches. It's made of vellum pages decorated in painted images, which are accompanied by Latin text in various colors of ink. And vellum, is animal skin, so that's what it was made out of. Includes, like I said, the complete Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and part of John that has been lost. They think that there was the full Gospel of John, but that has been lost. It was originally bound by a cover of gold and jewels, but the manuscript was stolen from the abbey in about 1007 CE, and it seems like the ornate binding was torn off by the thieves and everything, and possibly that's when the part of the Gospel of John was lost as well. They think that it was created by three separate anonymous scribes. Now they refer to them as Hand A, Hand B, and Hand C. It was really common for more than one scribe to work on a manuscript or even a single page of the book. You would proofread for each other for errors and sort of do this layered style of illuminating. And these were monks that created this. Monks who worked on books were known as scriptors and worked in rooms called scriptoriums. And you can picture this. The scriptorium was a long room lit only by the light from the windows, with wooden chairs and writing tables. And a monk would sit hunched over these tables, angled upward to hold manuscript pages and complete the work over days and days and weeks and weeks. Candles, oil lamps were not allowed to maintain the safety of the manuscripts. Obviously, fire was a serious concern back then. So you would only work during the daylight hours when you could have the natural light coming through the windows. The monks were involved in every aspect of bookmaking, from the cultivation of the animals whose skins they would use for the pages, processing it into vellum, and then going on and cutting it down to size. So, you know, I'm just fascinated by the physical process of making a book. If you've watched the newest Little Women adaptation, one of my favorite parts is at the end when they really take a long time to show how Jo's book, Little Women, is created. And it's just so satisfying to see sort of each page being glued and the cover, the binding coming together and everything like that. I think we've lost a little bit of the satisfaction of physical objects and the artistry it would take to create them. So you think about before the age of mass production and everything like that, and certainly before the printing press, what it would take to create a book, and books were so valuable. If you had a book, you were considered quite a wealthy person. If you had more than one, you were, even better off. And so these books were absolutely cherished. And most people couldn't read, right? So having an illuminated manuscript like this would draw people in. And it really, as I said before, was an evangelistic tool. I think now about, reading to my toddler, and she's really into the pictures, of course, and into the sound of the rhythm of the words and everything like that. And I think that people back then, probably for better in some ways, were able to receive these things like children with this sort of awe and amazement, just taking in the beauty of the pictures, really being transported by the words. And you think at Mass, they were talking in Latin, they couldn't even understand what was going on. So you would really, a illuminated manuscript like this would be very transporting. It would help to bring these gospel stories to life. It would be a amazingly beautiful, unique symbol to have in your church. So I love to hear about just the physical reality of this book. The text was written first in black ink between the ruled lines by one monk, and then would be given to the next to proofread. Second monk would then add titles in blue or red ink, mostly they think made from plants, and then pass the page on to the illuminator, who would add images, color, silver or gold. And these monks would write with quill pens and boiled iron tree bark and nuts to make the black ink. And other ink chemicals were produced by grinding and boiling different natural chemicals in plants. Again, just so fascinating to think about the level of work it would take. Now we just take so much for granted, don't we? In my printer, I just like order a cartridge of ink. I don't think about where it comes from or paint. So like where, if I'm painting a room in my house, that the effort it would take to create that color. So when we look at a book like the Book of Kells, not only are we appreciating the beauty of it, but we're appreciating the artistry and what it took to create something like this. And I think that it can make us appreciate books. It can make us appreciate the Gospels. It can make us appreciate art in a whole new way. Here's a nice quote I really liked from Thomas Cahill. He is a scholar who wrote about the development of literacy and bookmaking in Ireland, and he said, "Nothing brought out Irish playfulness more than the copying of the books themselves. They found the shapes of letters magical. Why, they asked themselves, did a bee look the way it did? Could it look some other way? Was there an essential bee-ness? The result of such why is the sky blue questions was a new kind of book, the Irish Codex. And one after another, Ireland began to produce the most spectacular, magical books the world had ever seen." the Book of Kells, of course, being one of them. So I, you know, you all know I love Celtic things and Irish history and things like that. So another reason to love the Book of Kells is that we get to see sort of the unique artistry of the Irish and like he said, that unique playfulness, you know, that a letter would be an invitation to meditate on what type of art that letter inspires. What does a bee make you think of? How can we draw little knots and figures into the two circle-shaped O's in a bee? And how does that look different than an M and everything like that? So I think that's beautiful. Again, you know, this is just a new way of seeing. When we all know to, we all learn to read at some point, right? So at some point, everything I'm looking at in my notes here and everything like that were just a blur of images. But in a way, maybe I was able to see sort of the personality of letters in a different way. I can remember that as a kid when you would write out your letters, and I had definite like feelings about what an A was like or a C or something like that. And but then you learn to read and you just sort of start taking these things for granted. So looking at the Book of Kells, we can start even rediscovering the magic of letters themselves. And just one other unique thing I found really fascinating about the Book of Kells is some of the motifs that will come up again and again. And one of them is peacocks. Peacocks are all over this book. So I think that's really, really interesting. They function as symbols of Christ throughout the book. According to earlier accounts given by Isidore of Seville and Augustine in the City of God, the peacock's flesh does not putrefy. So the animals therefore became associated with Christ via the resurrection. So isn't that fascinating? And it's so interesting if you know anything about, you know, the Catholic writer Flannery O'Connor, she kept peacocks and loved them. And I wonder, I can only assume that she knew about this symbolism, but it just sort of adds a whole new thing about my understanding of Flannery O'Connor now, and just a new symbol here in these beautiful illuminated Gospels in the Book of Kells. So the Book of Kells has long been associated with St. Columba. It was often referred to as St. Columba's book in contemporary texts at the time. But it really seems like the book was created quite a few years, about 100, 200 years after St. Columba died. So probably not, but very likely was created by the monks at St. Columba's monastery. So there is some association with St. Columba there. If you don't know who St. Columba is, he's considered one of the like sort of three patron saints of Ireland, along with St. Patrick and St. Bridget. So St. Columba also is quite famous in the Celtic Isles here for apparently dispelling the Loch Ness Monster. So that's pretty interesting. In the life of St. Columba, it was written that he was on the lake, and there was a monster going after some people, had killed some people, and he sent one of his monks into the water to go get a boat from across the way. And of course, right then, the monster came out of nowhere, about to attack the monk, and St. Columba rebuked it in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and told it to be gone, and the monster fled in terror. So thank you, St. Columba, for ridding us of the Loch Ness Monster. So I hope this was just a fun little introduction to the Book of Kells. I really want to encourage you to go look at it, to look at the digitized version. You can, of course, order prints and things like that. I ordered just a little sort of diptych from Etsy that has the two most famous images, one of the Virgin and Child, one of Christ. And it's beautiful. I love having it. I definitely would love to get some prints from it. I did get a pretty decent, you know, not that big, but a book about the Book of Kells that I will put a link in the show notes to. It has a fair number of pictures in it with pointing out the different symbology and motifs and things like that. It's where I learned about the peacocks. I did find that to be a helpful book. But yeah, I just wanted to introduce you all to this beautiful, beautiful work of art that is just, there are so many ways to look at it that I think inspire us, inspire wonder and awe. So I hope that you will look into it some more. Of course, it's a really, you know, it's a visual object. So there's only so much I can bring to life here on the podcast. So you will definitely have to go look it up for yourself. I wanted to go through a few things, a few Celtic stories and myths and aspects of culture here. I'm going to actually use some audio from a podcast I did before this one called On Fairy Stories. You can still find on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts, but it was from my first episode that I made early on in quarantine of last year when I was really getting into these. I was reading a lot of fairy tales and a lot of myths and things like that. Found it very enlightening in light of the strange things that were happening in the world to be sort of immersed in timeless stories. They really rooted me very well. So I was reading a lot about Selkies and these Irish myths and things like that. So I'm going to take some of my audio from On Fairy Stories and introduce you to some of the myths around Selkies. But I also wanted to talk about, and forgive me for my pronunciation, I've listened to the sort of YouTube videos of how to pronounce these things, but I may still not be perfect. But I want to talk about Tírnanog, which is the land of eternal youth in Irish Celtic mythology. Just this sort of amazing Eden-esque place of happiness and bounty, you know, endless hunting and orchards, and you also never get old there. So it's a sort of like a place that people, they find their way to under magical circumstances. So there are lots of great stories about Tírnanog, and the most famous one is about Oisín and Niamh. And just to give you an example of how difficult it is to pronounce these things, Niamh is pronounced Niamh, but spelled N-I-A-M-H. Not very intuitive, so. But anyway, okay, so Oisín was a great warrior, part of this big clan of hunters in Ireland, a very proud people. And one day they were out hunting and they come across this beautiful white horse with a woman riding it. She has long red hair. She's absolutely just stunning, takes everyone by surprise. And she says that she's heard rumors about this great, great warrior, Oisín, and she wants to take him with her to the land of Tírnanog. And she's the daughter of the king. So she wants to take him with her. And Oisín pretty much immediately agrees. He doesn't have to be too convinced. He's already fallen madly in love with this woman whose name is Niamh. So he hops on the white horse with her, and in sort of a parting of the Red Sea fashion, they ride through the ocean as it parts for them toward the land of Tírnanog. And there they are married, and they have three children, and it's estimated people normally stay in Tírnanog for something like 300 to 300 years, some number with three in it. So it feels like maybe 3 years to Oisín, but it is really been 300 years. And he's, you know, it's been a beautiful life for him in this land of eternal youth and eternal plenty. And but he is homesick. He's homesick for his family and for the Irish landscape, and he's homesick for home, so he'd like to go visit. Basically, he'd like to go back, and Niamh reluctantly agrees to let him go, but warns him, you know, take the white horse, but don't get off. If your feet touch the ground, you won't be able to come back. So he does go back to Ireland, but he is completely dismayed, sort of in a Rip Van Winkle way, to find that so much time has passed. 300 years have passed, not 3 years, and everyone he knows is dead. The landscape has changed. The castles he knew are in ruins. So he's pretty upset as he wanders this Ireland that is no longer familiar to him. But he comes across a group of young men who are trying to lift their variations about what they're working on, a marble stone, a boulder, and they ask for his help. And he, without thinking, gets off the horse, and immediately as his feet touch the ground, he ages 300 years into a very stooped and sick old man. And these young men are absolutely shocked as they watch the white horse gallop away from him. And they take him to no other than St. Patrick. And St. Patrick welcomes him to the monastery and nurses him back to health. And there are actually all these really interesting recordings of the dialogue they had, St. Patrick and Oisin. And it's seen as sort of a dialogue between the old Celtic pagan ways and this new Christianity that St. Patrick had brought into the land. And there's sort of a debate about salvation and about who is saved or isn't and who God is and if God is present in nature or not. And St. Patrick and Oisin go back and forth on this. It's really interesting definitely a very symbolic representative of this changing landscape culturally in Ireland as St. Patrick and other missionaries brought Christianity to the land. But in all the stories, St. Patrick does have Oisin tell him all about this land of Tiernanog, which they both kind of agree is heaven, is a form of heaven. You know, St. Patrick thinks that maybe somehow this man has visited heaven. And so they talk back and forth about what it's like. And what's so interesting is that in many stories about Tiernanog, there actually is a tree and there are apples, and there are just lots of things that make it a very Eden-esque place. So very interesting, and eventually, of course, Oisin dies in the care of St. Patrick. So speaking of lost Edens, I've recently discovered stories about this wonderful island, which is off the coast of County Kerry in Ireland, called Great Blasket Island. So it's this small, dramatic island, you know, with these cliffs over the raging Irish Sea. You can only get there by boat, of course. It's about a little over a square mile, so about, you know, 700 some acres, and even at its peak of occupation, there were only about 160 people living there. It was a really, really rough landscape. People would have to tie themselves with rope to trees as they walked along the edge of the cliffs so they wouldn't get swept away into the sea. There was no access to doctors or anything like that. They were all Catholics, but they obviously didn't have a church, so a priest would sort of row himself out there. Hopefully once a week, but at least once a month or so. They basically retained a technology-less existence for much longer than other parts of Ireland, and had a very, very traditional lifestyle that was extremely rooted in the land and the sea. And some of the great Irish stories were preserved by this largely oral tradition. It was also one of the last places to be entirely Irish-speaking. So luckily, people have preserved stories from the people who used to live there. By the mid-1950s, pretty much everyone had left the island. So that's now only two people will live there, two caretakers, if you want to apply to be a caretaker. I think they had thousands of people apply last year. It sounds like a pretty rough life in a lot of ways. You still don't have any electricity or anything, but if you just look up pictures of this place, it might be worth it. It looks pretty fantastic. So no one lives there except for caretakers, but you can go visit. So it's certainly going on my list. This is Great Blasket Island. So one of Ireland's most famous storytellers came out of this place. Her name's Peig Sayers. I'm reading her book now, and it's hard to describe. It's a little bit hard to understand. This has been translated from the original Irish, and some of her stories will seem just sort of bizarre, and they're all meandering. But as you sort of fall into the rhythm of the way she tells stories and this life that they were leading, this very, very rooted, simple in some ways, life that was so so based on story and sitting around the fire and having this very close-knit community. And think about, if you don't have technology, you don't have a TV, you don't have a radio, you don't even necessarily have books, telling stories was so important. And there were stories that people would memorize, you know, every single line by heart, and it would take 12 nights to tell the story, and everybody would gather around from the village to listen. And so it's just, it paints such a fantastic picture. So its own sort of lost Eden in a way. Of course, very dangerous, a lot of deaths, a lot of avoidable tragedies because of how isolated they were, but it's just fascinating to learn about. So on that note of traditional Irish stories, we're going to learn more about Selkies now, and I will play this audio from my podcast on fairy stories.
So maybe people one time had the power to see what's hidden from us. In the hills, there's something to be seen, I'm sure of that. And on the sea. That's a quote from an old fisherman in Ireland. He's quoted in David Thompson's strange and beautiful book, The People of the Sea, Celtic Tales of the Seal Folk. This is one of the most unique, puzzling, and beautiful books I've ever read. My husband finds my newfound interest in Selkies, or the seal folk of the Celtic Isles, somewhat amusing. I guess it's sort of a strange interest, and I don't really know why these Selkies appeal to me so much. I watched this beautiful animated movie by an Irish animation studio called The Song of the Sea, and I was just really taken in by this story of a woman, a wife and a mother, who gives birth to her second child and then returns to the sea after finding her seal skin, and she goes back to the ocean. And there's sort of this whole other world of fairies and dreams and myths that's lurking under the surface of the world there in Ireland. And these stories just really struck me as very beautiful and very sad, sad in a good way, you know what I mean? Just really haunting. So I went about looking for books on Selkies, and this book by David Thompson kept coming up, The People of the Sea. It's considered a classic of ethnography, really, of capturing a time that has really disappeared now. Seamus Haney wrote the introduction to the edition I have. The book was originally published back in the 1950s. David Thompson himself also had a hard time describing his deep interest in the folklore around the gray seals. He said, quote, "I don't think of the stories that way, as lies or truth. I like to hear them, that's all." Selkie stories in general are largely sad, violent, and absurd. Some say the gray seals are fallen angels. Some say they're the souls of drowned sailors. There are stories of Selkie kings and their human children. And there are many beautiful stories of Selkie women who find their seal skin and return to the sea, but continue to leave fish for their human children and husband on the shore. There's no sort of uniform mythology to Selkie stories. Sometimes there were these really funny stories of seals who would give rides to men to the market to go get a beer, and then would come up on land as a man and have a few pints with them before returning to the sea. The whole book is sort of like a memory you can't really place. And the rhythms are of a really lost way of life, a life where you lived with the motions of the sea and of the seasons out on these sort of dramatic gray cliffs of Ireland. So it's as much a collection of Selkie tales as a record of the Isle folk who told these stories. They can really only be understood in a society that lived so closely to the earth. The sea and its inhabitants, these really human eyes, they talk a lot about the human eyes of the seals and how seals are known to weep and to mourn their dead, to mourn their mates when they're killed and their children. They haunted fishermen for generations. To give you an idea of the superstitious world of this society, it was seen as bad luck to save a drowning man because God in the ocean had claimed him, and you didn't interfere with the will of the sea. So Selkies, these gray seals, represented a bridge between men and the ocean, because they could live both on land and in the water. The Selkie became a conduit for the fears and dreams of these fishermen. And Thompson takes us into an Ireland filled with traveling storytellers and old black houses, an Ireland where every action had a prayer for raking the fire in the evening, an Ireland where myths and memories merged. You never really knew what was true and what wasn't. There was a sense that perhaps the world was changing and the magic was leaving the land, but there was a time, and it wasn't so long ago, when these strange and magical things truly did happen. And near the end of the book, Thompson recounts some of the old Selkie songs, and he describes how the seals seemed to know the old Gaelic melodies and how they even answered and finished the ballads of singers on the beach. And you have to ask, did the old songs come from the seals? Did the fishermen perhaps learn the songs from the Selkies? But now the songs are mostly lost. There's sort of a fragmented record of them. And there's no back and forth anymore between men and seals and between men and the sea. So a lot of the language and the stories are being lost. So it's a really sad, beautiful book that really captures some of the strange, imaginative stories about Selkies. So I thought I would recount one of the strangest of the Selkie stories that's included in this collection, David Thompson's collection. So in this story, there is a fisherman, and he has three sons, and they hear three knocks on the door. And in a lot of this Irish mythology, hearing three knocks was always sort of an ominous thing. It meant maybe death itself had come to your door. But they open the door and they see a man in white on a white horse, and he tells them that when they go out fishing tonight, they need to make sure to take a knife, a hook, and an axe. And then he rides off away over the rainy cliffs into the distance, and all the men sort of look at each other and are, you know, think it's a pretty strange thing that just happened, but they said, well, we better take those things. So they get a hook, a knife, and an axe, and they take them out on the ocean with them that night when they go fishing. Now, that night there was a terrible, terrible storm, one of those really wild storms that comes out of nowhere, and their boat is being rocked and pitched, and they're sure they're going to drown. And this tumultuous, giant tidal wave just comes roaring toward them, and one of the sons, just in a moment of just sort of insanity, grabs the hook and throws it into the wave. And it splits the wave in two, and the wave, sort of like a parting of the Red Sea situation, just glides by, splits in two and glides by them. And so the next time one of those big tidal waves come, they grab a knife and they throw it into the wave, and the same thing happens. And then the same thing happens again with the axe. And then on that last wave, after they've thrown the axe in and they've ridden that last wave out, they're sort of washed up on the shore. And they can see in the distance all the sort of broken and shattered pieces of wood from other ships that have not been so lucky. There are a lot of fishermen that died that night, clearly, out on the ocean. So they go home feeling very lucky to be alive. And, you know, they're drying off and everything, and they hear those three knocks again, and they look at each other, sort of scared. And sure enough, it's the man dressed in white on his white horse. And he tells them, I need the three sons who threw the objects into the waves to come with me. And they don't question it. They clearly have a reason now to trust this man. So they hop on the back of his horse and they fly away, you know, like Shadowfax or something, just off, away, away, miles and miles and miles. But it takes no time at all. They know they're traveling immense ground, but the horse is just sort of flying over the earth. And they reach this town, and they see it's sort of a gray, strange town, and all these women are out in the streets dancing and laughing and playing music, and there's sort of all these men walking around with this strange look in their eyes and these, like, just drawn look on their faces, and they look just absolutely ill, you know, but they're following these women around, like, in a daze. And they're clinging to the man in white on his horse and just sort of looking at each other in horror about where they've ended up. And they arrive at one of these old black houses. There are no windows on this house. And they go up to the door, and the man says, you know, I can't go in with you, but you're going to have to go in one at a time. and do exactly as they say. Do exactly as they say. So you go first. And he's thinking, who's they? And the first son goes in, and he walks in, and he finds a beautiful woman lying in the bed, looking up at him with a hook right in the middle of her forehead. And she says, you have to take it out. You have to take this hook out of my forehead. And he's absolutely horrified, but he does as she says and takes the hook out. And then he leaves the house. And then the second son comes in, and he finds a woman there, a beautiful woman on the bed. And the same situation. It's the knife is right in her forehead, and he goes up and pulls it out as she requests. And then the last son goes in, and he finds a beautiful woman with an axe in her forehead. And she asks him to take it out, and he learns from her. She says, you know, you were meant to be mine. You were meant to be ours. If you hadn't thrown those into the sea, you would be here with us. And he runs out in horror, thinking how these women could have claimed them in the ocean. And the man in white explains that all the men there in that town are the sailors who drowned, and these are the Selkie women who claimed them. And he tells them, you can never go fishing again, you can never go out on the sea, because your souls have been saved, because you came back and you saved these Selkie women, you saved them by pulling out your weapons, but they're going to be waiting for you in the ocean, so you can never go out to sea again. And they went back to their father, and this time the journey back took it felt like days. You know, it was a long journey. The flying Shadowfax moment was over. And they come back and they tell him what happened, and they agree that they will never go out to sea again, and they spend the rest of their life just sitting on the cliffside watching the waves. So hopefully you enjoyed those Selkie stories. I just think they are so magical and amazing. I do so highly recommend that book by David Thompson. It's sort of in the tradition of Peak Sayers in sort of capturing this original understanding of Irish folklore and the way people would talk about it, the way they would tell these stories that was so important to their culture for so long and that unfortunately is being lost. So I do recommend that, and if you are, especially if you're interested in the Selkies, because the stories are just fantastic. So I hope you have a great St. Patrick's Day, a great St. Patrick's Day week or month, and actually also this week, Friday, is the Feast of St. Joseph, so that's a solemnity. So if you are Catholic, you can eat meat on that day. So again, the hardship, not so bad. Again, think of our Orthodox friends. So you can celebrate St. Joseph on Friday, and Pope Francis is actually giving the shrine at Knock in Ireland international status on the Feast of St. Joseph. This is the Marian apparition that happened in Ireland. Knock is a village in County Mayo, Ireland, most famous for the Knock Shrine. This was where people believe that the Blessed Virgin Mary, St. Joseph, and St. John the Evangelist appeared on August 21st, 1879. The story is that it was raining and people saw this apparition, and which stayed there for the course of 2 hours as people came and went and watched this vision. And what's interesting to me is that unlike some other Marian apparitions where there's sort of a warning or a message, actually all the figures were completely silent. So people have their own interpretations of what this vision meant. And it's certainly unique considering the Irish gift of gab that the apparition in Ireland was a silent apparition. So anyway, so happy St. Patrick's Day, happy Feast of St. Joseph, happy almost spring, with lots to celebrate. If anyone is keeping track, when this airs tomorrow, it'll be 2 days away from when the baby is due, but I'm not optimistic that she wants to come anytime soon, so I don't know. I'm going to probably just call it a day on this season. My goal of the 10 episodes didn't happen, but we've got 9 episodes here of Born of Wonder, so I'm proud of that, and I'm glad to have you as listeners, and I hope to be back very soon. And if you want to visit bornofwonder.com and contact me about different topics you'd like me to explore in the next season, or just general feedback, and of course, as always, if you go to iTunes and you can leave a review, that is so appreciated and so helpful. So my recommendation today is to go listen to some or read some poetry of W.B. Yeats. the quintessential Irish poet, beautiful poetry, lots of poetry about fairies and the landscape and just this wonderful culture of Ireland. So go read some Yeats. I'm going to take some audio again from On Fairy Stories here. It's my husband, Chris, reading two of Yeats' poems. First, the beautiful poem, When You Are Old, and then The Stolen Child. So both classic, great Yeats poems. So I hope you enjoy those and then also go look up some more Yeats poetry. I think that would be the perfect way to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. I'm also, I don't know if this is related to St. Patrick's Day or it's just coincidence, but I'm reading a biography of Bobby Kennedy. There is a Bobby Kennedy four-part series on Netflix. If you think of a quintessential Irish Catholic family in the United States, you might immediately think of the Kennedys. So, and it's also just interesting to learn about sort of the history about Irish Catholicism in America and just the Irish integration into American society. And Bobby Kennedy is, I mean, maybe you already know a lot about Jack Kennedy. I don't know. I've just always been very interested in Bobby. So that's on Netflix. That's something you can watch. So learn about some big Irish Catholic families, read some Yeats, drink some Guinness, and listen to some good fiddle music. And I hope you have a very happy St. Patrick's Day. I'm Katie Marquette, and you've been listening to Born of Wonder.
When you are old. When you are old and gray and full of sleep, and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and of their shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace and loved your beauty with love false or true? But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face. And bending down beside the glowing bars, murmur a little sadly how love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead and hid his face amid a crowd of stars. Stolen Child by W.B. Yeats. Where dips the rocky highland of Sleuth Wood in the lake, there lies a leafy island where flapping herons wake the drowsy water rats. There we've hid our fairy vats, full of berries and of reddest stolen cherries. Come away, O human child, to the waters and the wild, with a fairy, hand in hand, for the world's more full of weeping than you can understand. Where the wave of moonlight glosses the dim gray sands with light, far off by furthest rosses we foot it all the night, weaving olden dances, mingling hands and mingling glances, till the moon has taken flight. To and fro we leap and chase the frothy bubbles, while the world is full of troubles and is anxious in its sleep. Come away, O human child, to the waters and the wild, with a fairy, hand in hand, for the world's more full of weeping than you can understand. Where the wandering water gushes from the hills above Glencar, in pools among the rushes that scarce could bathe a star, we seek for slumbering trout, and whispering in their ears give them unquiet dreams. Leaning softly out from ferns that drop their tears over the young streams. Come away, O human child, to the waters and the wild, with a fairy hand in hand, for the world's more full of weeping than you can understand. Away with us he's going, the solemn-eyed. He'll hear no more the lowing of the calves on the warm hillside, or the kettle on the hob sing peace into his breast, or see the brown mice bob round and round the oatmeal chest. For he comes, the human child, to the waters and the wild, with a fairy hand in hand, from a world more full of weeping than he can understand.
And here there is something more than just a transient experience.
It's about being. It's about the things that matter to me. It's about the white spaces between the paragraphs.
Then God said, "Let there be light."
It's a mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing.